In session two, Gary's going to continue to expand on this idea of having a strong financial house. He's going to show us how we can be managers of God's money and how to spend that money in a God-honoring way. And we're also going to go through the importance of having a will and also picking out and buying the right insurance.
I want to walk you through your booklet. There's a couple of tools in here I want to just kind of make clear to you so you can utilize those when you leave here. Find a page that says Financial Philosophy Assessment. Now, this is something you do. You don't do this together. You do this individually. And it's a most like me, least like me scenario. So you read the statement and you pick whether that's you think that's most like the way you think or least like the way you think. Don't overthink this. Now, here's the thing. You don't sit there and go, well, I probably do think that way, but I really should think this way. So you change your it's first impression. But you do this apart. When you get to the end and you tally it up, excuse me, on page 3, you'll see that these statements are reflective of beliefs, whether we're concerned with status or security or self-actualization or self-indulgence or where we kind of fall in this economic faith scale. So it's a great tool to kind of say, this is how I'm thinking right now. And you can use this as to look at this and start to ask God in your prayer time to change those attitudes so you can move into the more productive sides of this. Now, let me tell you, long term, if you have children, folks, your children are going to do exactly what you're doing when it comes to money. If that scares you, you need to change. Now, you'll have that rare child who will go the opposite direction, but they're in the minority. Most of them are going to do exactly what you're doing. They learn to manage money by watching you, by listening to you. And if what you're doing, you don't think is productive today, you need to change it so that you can have an impact on their lives so that they can go into adulthood and not struggle with the same issues that you struggle with when it comes to money. There's also a tool right behind that called the cash flow plan. For those of you who have zero plan right now, this is a good place to start. The instructions are on the first page, and there's a little spreadsheet behind it. You can fill that out manually to help you get on some sort of system for paying bills and setting aside money to cover bills the next week, to becoming proactive in this whole situation. So you can take that and utilize that. Okay? Now we're going to move on to the next thing, which we call the spending plan. Not a budget. You like that word budget? Anybody? What does budget usually mean? Like a budget hotel, right? Cut back, do without. It's got a negative connotation. We're talking about building a plan to spend God's money effectively. That's basically what we're doing. So how do you do that? You've got to set realistic goals. We've already talked about that once. Let me give you a real quick tool to use to set realistic goals. You sit down with a lined pad together. You need to be out where you're by yourself. No distractions. The kids aren't running around. You're not watching the football game in the other room or listening to it. You're doing this, focusing on this together. And there are two rules when you do this brainstorming. Number one, there are no limits. See, folks, with God, there are no limits. Yet we as humans tend to limit ourselves. There are no limits to what these goals can be. Because you're going to think of something, and right off the bat, something's going to come back and go, you can't do that. You haven't won the lottery yet. Right? The second rule is there's no laughing. We tend to talk each other out of stuff. Or we'll intimidate each other. Or we can't... No laughing, okay? Here's what the interesting thing is. If you'll sit down and do this and you just start putting down stuff, your tendency is going to be, oh, this is way too much. You're going to want to stop. You don't. You just keep going. As long as ideas are coming, you start writing them down. Now, here's the danger. You're going to end up with 3 pages worth of stuff. And you're going to look at that and you're going to go, we can never do all this. And that's possible. You may not be able to ever do all that. But you start somewhere and you take those 2 or 3 pages and you go in there and you highlight the 10 that are most important to you as a family at this point in time in your life. Pick the 10 most important, and those are the ones you're going to work on. And if you didn't accomplish anything else, you could accomplish those 10. What you're going to find, folks, is once you see that, you put it down and you prioritize those goals, and you put a timeline on them, and you start to assign a value to them, and you start working on them, you're going to start hitting that stuff because you've got a plan. And next thing you know, you've done number one, and number 11 moves up to number 10, and everything just keeps shifting up. And you'll be amazed at what you can accomplish. And the thing you can't forget to do when you're doing this is you cannot forget to include God in this plan and ask Him to bless these plans. He's got to be in the mix. It's not something you're going to do in your own power. So don't forget that. Now, where you're going to start, you're going to have to categorize your spending. In your booklet, you have, I've already done this for you, I've made it easy, a spending plan worksheet where you can start that process of categorizing your spending and break it down into major categories. What we do in the financial fitness program is we take this info and we put it in. We've got a computer program, we put it in, and it actually breaks it down for you. You can do it manually, though. And those percentages are a guide to what you should be doing. Now, you might want to go to Crown Ministries website. I think it's crown.org. And they have percentage guides for different income levels and different family sizes that you can print out. So you can use those guidelines once you break it down, all your spending by these percentages, and see, okay, this area's out of balance, this area's out of balance, this area. What can we do to reconfigure this whole thing so that we're more in where we should be, more in the area where we should be? So you categorize your spending. But that's what we think we do. You've got to verify these numbers, and the way to do that is to track your spending. Now, what we do when we have you track your spending is you write down every penny you spend for everything you spend it on every day. Now, for some of you, that sounds like a huge task. It actually takes you about 2 minutes a day to do that. Now, we do it, we've got these little booklets that we give people. So you can put your categories at the top. You see the example on the board. And then you can write down on a daily basis what you spend in each one of those categories. You'll have an epiphany because you're going to look at this and go, my goodness, I didn't even realize. How many times you go to Starbucks, never even think about it? You know, or you go out to eat. You do different things. What it's going to help you identify are unproductive habits you have that you weren't even aware of. And see, once you know what you're doing, then you can change what you're doing, right? If you don't know what you're doing, you have no reason to change. You don't even know what to change. This is an excellent way to determine where are we right now. Are these numbers that we put down on our spending plan worksheet even valid? What I find invariably, and I'll give you the example, is eating out. You know, eating out today is more of a lifestyle choice than it ever was. When I was a little kid, we maybe ate out once a month. Now, if people eat at home once a month, that's a big deal. But the fact is, we eat out a lot. And most people have no clue how much they spend eating out. By the way, you're going to spend about 35% more to eat out than you would if you prepared the meal at home and ate at home. But they'll start writing it down and go, my goodness, we've already spent $300 this month eating out. And they look on their budget plan and they put down, well, I think we spent $150. And this is your reality. To help you figure out, now that we can go, that's a behavior we need to change. If we needed money to save for another item, we could eat out less and take that savings and put it over here against this goal. You need to incorporate your goals into this. Now, what I mean by that is, let's say that you have a goal of putting a kid through college. And let's assume that you're pregnant right now, girls. And you want to put this kid through college. Well, I can tell you the math. The math is that you're going to have to start saving, the minute that kid is born, about $180 a month at 8% in order to provide full funding for college at 18. Where are you going to get the $180 a month? You're going to have to make lifestyle changes. Every goal has a price. Every goal can be quantified to some extent. And then you incorporate that goal into your spending plan, so where it becomes a new line item in that printout. that our goals are going to be X amount of dollars. Well, I don't have that X amount of dollars. Where up here can I find it in my budget, in my spending plan? But folks, let me tell you something. Giving has to be a part of your spending plan. It can't be, I need to get out of debt first and then I'll start giving. Let me tell you something. You will probably, with that attitude, you will probably never, ever get out of debt. God expects us to give. Now, God doesn't need your money. Don't misunderstand me. It's an act of obedience. It's an act of worship. You're basically telling God, I recognize where my provision is coming from, and I choose to give a portion of that back so it can be used for kingdom purposes. It's not an option. If you're not giving right now, you need to understand that you're in disobedience. I'm not going to mince words with you. So my encouragement, you go, well, I can't give 10%. Okay. There's nothing in the New Testament says you have to give 10%. As a matter of fact, Paul says in Corinthians, each man should give as he purposes in his heart, not under compulsion. What does that mean? Not because someone told me I have to, or because I feel I have to, but God loves a cheerful giver. So he wants you to give, but he wants you to give with the right heart. If you're not giving anything now, start giving something. It doesn't matter if it's a dollar. Every time you get paid, you make sure that you systematically begin to give a portion of that back. And you have a goal of 10%. Now, if you want to get legalistic about the tithe, it was really about 33%. Oh, let's don't talk about that. Let's go back to 10. I like 10 better. 10's more attainable. The fact is, it's not the amount. It's the heart with which you give it. But a 10 is a great goal to work toward. And you're going to find something, folks, and you may have experienced this at your job when they start offering a retirement plan, and you never had saved money in your retirement plan before, but you decided you're going to start putting $50 a month away, and you're like, I don't really know how I'm even going to pay my electric bill with this $50 a month coming out of there. And after about 3 or 4 months, you didn't even miss it anymore, did you? But you know what? They don't give you the same thing God gives you when you invest in kingdom things. And he is going to bless your obedience. I don't know how, because he's got a specific will for your life. But he's going to bless that obedience. It may be with more money. He may choose to do that. We're not talking prosperity theology. He may choose to do that. But he may just give you a peace about your situation you've never had before. He may heal a relationship that's needed to be healed because now you're in obedience. But whatever his will for your life is, he's going to work within that context, and he's going to bless you for your obedience. So this has to be an integral part of your spending plan. It can't be left out. It can't be one of those, I'll add it in later. It has to go in at the beginning. And folks, write a check. Don't just put cash in there, because you need to take advantage of the tax benefits of contributing to a nonprofit too. That's being a good steward too. You know, write a check, even if it's for a dollar. Now we're going to move on to asset protection, which is a fancy term for insurance. A necessary evil in our world today, but you don't have to pay too much for it. With any insurance, the principle is you get the most you can for the least amount of money. Isn't that how you want to buy anything? You need to educate yourself. Now, how do you do that? Consumer Reports has excellent articles at least annually on insurance that it broken down into lay terms. You can understand it. Or you find somebody who's a biblical financial advisor who will help you understand it. And you can take some of these principles we're going to share today. It may be enough for you to move to that level. The next thing we're going to do, after educating yourself, is that you need to understand the relationship between the deductible and the premium. The lower your deductible, because I don't want to pay very much if I have a wreck, the higher your premium is going to be. It's a seesaw relationship. So the higher your deductible, the lower the premium is going to be. But if you have a lower premium because you're paying for a higher deductible, how long are you going to pay that lower premium? Forever. Or you can go, I really don't want, if in case I have a wreck, which typically is only like 3 to 4 times in your driving life, in case I have a wreck, I don't want to pay very much, but I will agree to pay this higher premium for the rest of my life. So you get the highest deductible you can afford. Now, here's the asterisk. You remember your emergency fund you had? $1,500? That can be your deductible. If you have a home, you need to make sure, if you haven't done it, that you declare the homestead exemption in the state of Texas. Take advantage of that. That lowers your tax base and it protects your home from a lot of things. Seizure by the IRS, among those things. Insure your home for the replacement value. Here, folks, I see over-insured homes every day. We're talking about replacement value if the home were to burn down. If you bought a house, then you bought a house that was worth, let's say, $150,000. It sits on a foundation that sits on a what? A lot, right? Dirt won't burn, will it? And it won't blow away. It's there. Yet most of the times when we insure our home, we call the insurance agent. When we buy it, we say, we paid $150,000 for this home. They insure it for $150,000. How much was that lot worth? 20 or 30? So we're right there overinsured because we've insured the lot. You need to insure for the replacement cost of the structure only. Now, you're going to have to do some research in order to figure out what that amount is so that you can talk intelligently to your agent, because they're going to do the best they can to talk you out of that. Check your liability limits. We tend to, because we live in a state of fear in this country. If they sue me, I want to have the most liability I can have. Let me tell you, the very first thing that lawyers look at when they get ready to sue you is, how much insurance do you have? Now, if you don't have a lot of other assets beside your house and you have the homestead exemption, and all you have are two cars and, like typical people, I mean, if you've got property and boats and all that stuff, this probably isn't going to apply to you. But you don't need maximum liability insurance, because there are some things, if they sue you, they cannot get. But they can get that insurance money. Every year they renew your homeowner's policy. You can flip through there and look at, see what they've tacked on for riders. Glass replacement. They might have jewelry and furs in there and you have neither. They have all kinds of stuff that they'll add on, and they know people do not, by nature, read that policy. And so things will go on there, and next thing you know, you're paying for stuff you don't even have. You can call them and say, I want that off, I want that off, and I want that off. You're the one paying for it. Okay? Again, get the highest deductible you can afford. Now, the rule of thumb today with insurance, homeowners insurance, is they make it for 1% of the value of the home, typically. The home is valued at $160,000. Your deductible is $1,600. If you had $4,000 in your emergency fund, you could actually ask for a higher deductible. The thing is, in most cases, if it's not a big deal, are you going to call them and claim it on your homeowner's insurance anyway? Because what are they going to do after you file? They're going to jack your premiums up. So you're going to try to fix everything you can yourself anyway. So you still want to strive for that. Insurance, folks, is intended to do nothing more then cover that asset at the minimum cost. That's what really it is for you. You're supposed to, it's just for catastrophic loss. It's not for everyday little stuff. Okay, let's talk about annual quotes. You're going to hear this both in, when we talk about auto in a minute. Every year, get a quote. My parents were with a well-known, I won't say their name, State Farm Insurance, for 40 years, never, ever moved, never got quotes. Every year they jacked up their rate a little bit. Had lived in a little old frame home down in Victoria, Texas. When my dad passed away about 4 years ago, I got to look at all their stuff, because he took care of everything, but he was still kind of close with it. They were paying double the premium I'm paying on my home here in Rowlett for that little old frame house. Never thought anything about it. And they could have saved thousands of dollars. Every year, get a quote. Because what they'll do is they put inflation factors on these things, and because whatever, the value of your home goes up 4 or 5%. Next year, guess what? When the value of your home goes up, what does your premium do? Goes up with it. And they do that. They stare at it. Next thing you know, you've got a home that replacement costs $160,000. You look on your policy and it's insured for $250,000. They're not going to, if your house burns down, they're not going to put a $250,000 house on that lot, folks. If your house burns down, they're going to replace that house. So it's worth it to you to find an independent agent and get quotes every year to make sure, again, that you're utilizing God's dollars effectively. Let's talk about auto insurance. Again, check your liability limits. Same concept as homeowners. You want to be careful you're not overinsured. Get the highest deductible you can afford. Once your emergency fund is in place, then you get the highest deductible. I carry a $1,000 deductible on my collision on my cars, because I've got the money earning interest in my account that I'm not going to pay extra premium to the insurance company that I'll never get back. Check your coverages. Make sure that you have the right kind of coverage. Collision, we all need that if you've got the car financed. However, if your car is 6 or 7 years old and paid off, there comes a point there where it doesn't behoove you to carry collision on it anymore. Hondas and European cars will maintain their value longer, but for most American cars, once it's 6 or 7 years old, if it's paid for, it's not helping you any to pay that extra money for collision, because more than likely, if you wreck the car, they're going to total it. And then they're going to pay you what wholesale wrecked is on the thing, which isn't much. Look at your comprehensive, they call it OTC or other than collision now. Make sure you have, that's windshield replacement, typically, or if you get water in your car. And a lot of people just carry a $50 deductible on that. You don't have to do that. If you carry a $50 deductible and you get your windshield replaced, guess what? Your premium's going to go up a little bit. And it goes up, it never goes back down. Replace your windshield, just pay cash for it. That's what your emergency fund is for. And then PIP is called personal injury protection. If you have a good insurance program at work where you have like Blue Cross Blue Shield or hospitalization policy, you really don't need that coverage. That's just kind of double coverage. Now, if you don't have any kind of coverage at all, keep it. It's not that expensive, but it's not needed if you have good insurance coverage. Okay, let's talk about life insurance. Life insurance has one purpose only, and that's to replace the income of the breadwinner to the family, period. It's not a savings program. It's not a tax deferral program. It is strictly insurance. Again, you get the most you can for the least amount of money. What you typically want to buy is enough to replace the breadwinner, which the rule of thumb is 6 to 8 times the annual income of the breadwinner. So if a person's making $50,000 a year, they need between $300,000 and $400,000 worth of coverage. You need to buy term insurance when you buy life insurance. Now that goes against everything that all the insurance people talk about. But again, you want to get the most you can for the least amount of money. Now, here's the way this works. This is a financial planning concept that Vanita Van Caspel wrote in her book, Financial Planning for America, about 20 years ago. It's called The Theory of Decreasing Responsibility. That let's say you're 35 years old today, you have a mortgage, you have children at home, you, like most folks, have debt, and you're both dependent on each other's income. So the loss of income is an issue. Well, right now, at this point, this stage of your life is your highest point of liability. So that's when you need the most insurance, that $300,000 to $400,000, or maybe more if you make more than that. But you also need to be saving money down here. And we're going to talk about that in the last segment. But over time, if time is going this way, over time, the savings grows. If you get on a plan, what we're going to talk about in the next segment, get your house paid off, these guys do grow up, right? And you have a choice whether or not you let them move back home or not. You get your debt paid off, then the loss of income becomes less and less and less of an issue as time goes on. So as your savings grows, your need for insurance goes down. And as you get out here to retirement age, whatever that might be, 60 to 70 or older, you really don't need to be paying anything for insurance. You need to have been a good saver and built an estate, and your estate replaces your need for insurance. Does that make sense? Okay. So in order to afford this kind of coverage, you need to buy term insurance. And in term means it's for a period of time. So you buy level term, which is level premium, so you know what you're paying every month, it stays the same, and level coverage. Now, if you're doing this correctly, your need for coverage should really never rise, because you're really talking about reducing all your liabilities here, which this will cover. Let's say that you have a newborn. Your highest point of responsibility was the minute that kid was born, because now for the next 18 to 22 years, you are completely responsible for the well-being of that other, that human being. That means providing food for them and shelter and clothing. So that's when you're totally dependent on your income. But as they grow up and move out, you don't need that much anymore. So if you're a young couple and you have young kids, you can probably get a 20-year level term policy. I've seen 25 and 30 now. But for 20 years, your premium and your coverage are the same. They're level. You know what you're paying every month. Then after they grow up, after this 20-year period of time, you can start reducing that coverage, paying less for it, as you funnel that money the other way into savings. So you can get level premium and level coverage in 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35-year policies. And you can cancel it anytime you want to. So you want to get, again, the most you can for the least amount of money and apply this long-term to the plan. You want to get out of the insurance business, by the way. The faster you can save money effectively and accumulate it, you want to get rid of insurance. Now we're going to look at a will or an estate. In the state of Texas, folks, it's a must that you have a will. We're what's called a probate state. Some of the laws have been on the books for 150 years. It is a must that you have a will. Now, if you don't have any complications to your will, like if there aren't any, there's not a previous marriage where children are involved or anything like that, a lot of times you can go over here to Office Max and they've got a packet for Texas that has the will in it, the living will, power of attorney, all those forms in there you can fill out. You don't necessarily have to go to a lawyer. If there are situations that are going to complicate that, like you have a previous marriage, you have children from a previous marriage, that kind of thing, then you need to go ahead and have a lawyer draw up your papers. This is an investment you need to make. You don't make it for you. You make it for your family so that they don't have to deal with all this stuff in case something happens to you. One of the greatest acts of love you can do for your family is to make sure that there's a will in place so that they don't have to deal with all the mess that comes after that. Okay? In Texas, you need to set it up as your goal over the next 7 days. By the end of 7 days, next Saturday, you have a will. Go ahead and write that down now and do it. Don't put it off and wait and wait and wait. You're not doing it for you. You're doing it for them. I want you to all close your eyes for a minute. I want you to think about how would it feel? Not how it would be, but how would it feel if you today were totally and completely debt-free? No house payment, no car payments, no grandma payments, no student loans, no credit card. You were totally and completely free of debt. How would you feel?